Morning, Council.
Good morning.
Mr. Higa, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, I am.
Please do so.
May I please the court, Emlyn Higa, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for the state appellant in this action. The state in this case is appealing specifically the conclusions of law made by the court below, conclusions 1, 6, and 7, which basically say the same thing. The court below, in conclusions of law 1, 6, and 7, basically saying that the legislative intent was not to have abuse of a family or household member charged with a continuing offense. The court below, I think, was correct in saying that we have to look to determine the legislative intent to address the issue of whether continuing course of conduct can be charged for abuse. Where we disagree with the court is where the court basically put aside the specific test enunciated in Martin for this purpose and basically determined its own test to find legislative intent. The Martin case gives us a specific test to determine legislative intent as to continuing course of conduct. It's a test that's specifically made for that purpose. The court below disagreed.
Isn't the Martin test an evidentiary test? Same impulse, same intent? Isn't that an issue of evidence, not necessarily an issue of legislative intent?
That portion of it I agree. I think when they talk about it's a continuing offense, if there's one general plan, one intention, one scheme, etc. But that's a test I would submit. That's a factual test that enunciates what the state would have to prove below to a to the trier of fact. If we charge a continuing course of conduct over a period of time, then we're saying there's not separate instances of abuse. This whole period is one abuse. In order to prove that to the jury, I would submit that that's then what we would have to prove. We have to prove to the jury that all of these instances of physical abuse are connected by one intention, one plan, one scheme. If we fail, so that, for example, let's say we prove to the trier of fact beyond a reasonable doubt, or the trier of fact says, well, yeah, I can find beyond a reasonable doubt that this one instance when he slapped her on this particular date, that did happen. You prove that all the elements, you prove that the defendant intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly caused bodily injury to his wife on this particular day. But I don't see one intention, one scheme, one plan over this period of time that you've charged. We lose. Then the verdict is not guilty, because what we've charged is a continuing offense. So it's not sufficient for us just to prove one particular instance.
But a continuing offense, where you have to prove that it occurred over the 2-year period, or you lose?
Yes. Yes.
So if you prove 18 months and not 24 months, you lose?
I think we, no. No.
But I mean, we have to prove a continuing course. How would the jury be instructed under your theory?
Using language like what the court just referred to in Martin, part of the jury instruction regarding continuing course of conduct would be that the state would have to prove that all of these various instances of abuse are connected in a single plan or intention, that would be part of our proof. So in essence, charging continuing course of conduct would be a more difficult case to prove for the state.
So why would the state charge it that way?
Because in certain cases, the judgment that we would make, I would submit, would be that it is a clearer, more persuasive picture to give to the jury. If we bring, for example, if a husband slaps his wife, intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly causing bodily injury to her, and we bring that before a jury, Well, you know, practically speaking, okay, but it was just one slap. It was just one instance. You know, it didn't even leave a mark. You know, what's the big deal? If the jury, on the other hand, if we were able to charge as a continuing course of conduct, if it's an appropriate case, and show continuing course of conduct, that, yeah, this is one slap in a whole series of slaps, punches, kicks. So that basically the entire abusive relationship, so to speak, can be presented to the jury, then it's not just, oh, he just slapped her this one time. No. These things have been going on for 2 years, say. If, let's say, we charge 2 years, but we prove a continuing course of conduct that stretches over 1 year, I would submit that we would still be entitled to a conviction, because what we have to prove is a continuing course of conduct. Time or the date of offense, again, is not a material element. It's just that we would have to prove that there was an extensive period of time in which
there
was.
It's clear that you can charge under the abusive family household member statute discrete incidents, correct?
Right.
I mean, the state does it all the time.
Right.
All right, so what about the statute indicates to you that convince us the legislature intended to be able to charge it as a continuing offense? What's in the statute? You're explaining why, tactically, the state may want to do that.
Yes.
But I don't know that the state's tactical choices affect what the legislature intended.
That's what brings me back to that portion of Martin. If I might just have a moment. In State v. Martin, under the Section C heading statute limitations, the second paragraph, the court indicated the language of the theft statute plainly manifests a legislative intent to prohibit continuing conduct. I'll skip over certain portions there because the elements listed, quote, involve conduct that can extend beyond isolated moments, end quote. So what I'm saying here is that Martin says, how do we find out whether the legislature plainly intended that certain conduct could be charged as continuing course of conduct? The test is, when you look at the involved conduct, does that language denote conduct that can extend beyond isolated moments? If it can, then the option is open for us to charge it as a continuing course of conduct.
Okay, so that would apply not only to this offense, but to virtually every other offense, unless the legislature specifically prohibited charging it as a continuing course of conduct.
Yes.
All right, wouldn't your argument basically obviate the statute of limitations in virtually every offense in the penal code?
No.
Why not?
Well, certainly, to pick a core example, say the period of time over which there was a continuing course of conduct of abuse, that entire period of time is more than 2 years ago, and we're looking at a misdemeanor charge. Then, of course, that whole period of time is beyond the statute of limitations of 2 years. We cannot charge that. Under, I think it's 701-108, if the last instance is within the two-year statute of limitations, then we've satisfied the statute of limitations. Now, I know the court below and probably this court has some issue as far as, well, that means that we could, as long as the last instance of abuse was within 2 years of the charge, basically, we could charge going back, you know, any amount of time. I would say that is what the law permits. In any continuing course of conduct, as long as the last instance is within the statute of limitations, then the whole period can be charged. The protection that the defense has on that is if, because of the lapse in time, there is actual prejudice, then a pre-accusation delay motion can be brought, a motion to dismiss for pre-accusation delay. That's the whole purpose of that kind of a motion for pre-accusation delay is for those cases where there is not a violation of statute of limitations, but there is still actual prejudice to the defense because of the delay in which they've lost evidence, for example.
What about concerns under Rule 404 or Rule 403, where if your position is, I can charge back countless number of years, and even if I prove only, say I charge back 5 years, but I only prove it happened in the last 3 years, but I got evidence in for all those 5 years, I mean, don't you get to a real concern about Rule 404 or Rule 403?
It would be, no. The reason for that is this, that for one, it's charged conduct now, right? If we charge a period of time and we prove instances within that period of time or present evidence of instances within that period of time, then that's charged conduct. It's not 404B evidence.
No, but if you charge a year before the statute, if you charge a three-year period, 1 year before the statute, mm-hmm. you prove period within the statute, but you put on evidence of assaults that occurred before, mm-hmm. you're putting it on charged conduct. Or 404B conduct, that if you had correctly charged the offense, you wouldn't be able to just get that in as direct evidence of the crime.
If I had charged as a discrete offense, yeah, then I would, like if I charged...
But your argument is that if I charge it broadly enough, then there's never any 404B evidence. Everything's direct evidence. But I can prove a more discrete period of time, so, mm-hmm. I mean, how does that square with the ability of the court to regulate what fairly comes in as evidence under 404B or 403?
Yeah, well, similarly, if we had, say, five abuses that occurred within the statute of limitations, within the last 2 years, there were five abuses. If I only charged the fifth, then yeah, there'd be a 404B issue as to whether I could get in evidence of 4321. If I charge all five in the single complaint, then at trial, I can bring in evidence of all
five.
Yeah,
but you couldn't charge it if it's before the statute.
Pardon?
You couldn't charge it if the discrete incident occurred before the statute of limitations.
Yeah.
So by charging a period of time that goes into the period that would otherwise be barred by the statute, you are creating what you argue is direct evidence in situations that may not be direct evidence. I mean, isn't that prejudicial? Isn't that something? You're arguing that the prosecutor has some discretion in deciding mm-hmm. how mm-hmm. to charge things. But isn't that discretion limited by the court's concerns about whether the charging choice made by the prosecutor is unfairly prejudicing the defense?
But again, I think the safeguards for that is pre-accusation delay motion. I think that's the safeguard as far as statute of limitations is concerned, or passage of time, any passage of time, whether it's within the statute or not. As to 404B, though, the same result happens. If we're talking in my example of like five abuses within the past 2 years, if I charge the fifth, then yes, the defense could say, well, you know, it's a 404B issue that he's talking about an abuse incident that happened 1.5 years ago. But then if I charge it, it becomes charged conduct and I can get that evidence in. That would be the same argument that the defense would the defense then have the same argument and say, hey, he circumvented 404B because he's actually charged those incidents now. No, we're entitled to charge those incidents, and if the incidents are charged, then it's not a 404B issue. It's charged conduct. It's not other crimes.
Yeah, but you couldn't charge an incident that occurred before the statute if you charge it discreetly.
Right.
So I don't understand the logic of your argument as to why just by charging it, you necessarily convert what otherwise would be a 404B issue into direct evidence.
It comes back to if I can prove it as a continuing course of conduct, because the whole idea of continuing course of conduct is it's one offense.
Right. Let me ask you about that. The cases that look at this continuing offense rationale, what they do is to say if it is a continuing offense, you don't need a unanimity instruction. Mm-hmm. If it's not, then you need a unanimity instruction. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen any case that says that you can have the jury make the decision. And what instruction would you give? What instruction would you have the jury? Because normally the fight is whether we have to instruct on specific unanimity or to elect a particular discrete incident or not. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen cases that said that the state's going to get up and try to argue it's a continuing offense.
Okay, I just want to
make sure. Have the jury make the finding that it's a continuing offense.
I'm not sure if I understand the question. Is it appropriate for the jury to make a are you asking, is it appropriate?
Well, under your theory, the jury would have to make that finding, right?
Yes.
Otherwise, you're cheating. You're charging something that you say is a continuing offense, but you're trying to prove it as a discrete incident. So how would you instruct the jury that they to make your charging technique valid?
That they would have to make a finding that all of these instances of abuse are connected as one continuing course of conduct. That is, that they are motivated by one intention, one plan, etc.
So the jury would be instructed that even if you found discrete incidents that would violate the statute, unless you find that it's a continuing offense as charged by the state, you must acquit the defendant?
Yes.
Have you ever seen a charge like that, instruction like that before?
Well, actually, I did. There was a jury trial that we brought on a continuing course of conduct abuse. We had some issues as far as being able to get in certain evidence. The trial court precluded me from putting in certain evidence. The jury, when we talked to them after, the jury found him not guilty. When I talked to them afterwards, they said, yeah, we could find beyond a reasonable doubt that he committed these acts of abuse, but we could not find any connection between them, and so we couldn't find a continuing.
All right. So how would the state be prejudiced if we said you can't charge it that way? You have to charge discrete incidents. The unit of prosecution is a discrete abuse. You have to charge it that way. What's the prejudice to the state?
Well, there's not any necessary prejudice. What it does is it takes away a tool that I would submit is available to us to make a more persuasive case in those kinds of cases in which proving a continuing course of conduct is more persuasive, as opposed to just showing one slap on one day, on one particular day. I'm trying to get back to the.
But if there's 10 slaps over a year, you charge 10 counts, and you can convince the jury that one of those slaps was sufficient to constitute physical abuse, you get a conviction, right?
Right. But there are those instances, I would say, where showing the whole course of the relationship, showing the connection between them, creates a more persuasive picture to the jury of the real danger that's involved. Like the jury that I was talking to you about that acquitted, they said, yeah, if we knew about certain things that happened in between to show that it was all part of a scheme, then we would have convicted. But that's the evidence that I was precluded from showing. But that's an evidentiary issue for the court below. Right now, I'm concerned about the legal issue of whether legally we can, the abuse statute permits a continuing course of conduct.
And charging as a continuous conduct under the abuse statute would not be very common, would it?
It would not. My prediction is that it would not, simply because I think in many cases that I look at, it would be difficult to show the connect-ups. It would be difficult to show something other than the discrete incidents. But there are those cases where, you know, you can, and we would want to do that.
Judge Nakamura points out, isn't it easier to show a discrete act?
It is. I mean, legally, yeah, but, you know, the issue is persuasiveness before the jury.
Even under your theory, continuing offense, if you charge a period that spans beyond the statute of limitations, wouldn't you have to show a discrete act that would satisfy the statute, the offense, within the statute of limitations?
Yes.
All right. So why do you get to throw in, based upon the charge, everything that happened beforehand?
Again, because it's a more persuasive case to prove. For example, if you had the transaction, so to speak, the incident, within the statute of limitations is that, well, you know, a third party saw the defendant grab his wife and slam her up against the garage door, and that's it. You know, a jury hears that, okay, so he slammed her up against the garage door and her back hurt. As opposed to...
Isn't that enough?
You know, a lot of times it's not. I mean, you'd be surprised the number of times you hear a jury say, well, we acquitted because what's the big deal? Okay, so he
right,
did
but
it, but it was only one time.
But
they're not following the jury instruction.
But it's a problem of proof, and that's why we're looking for this tool to use. I think that indicates my time is up. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Deputy Public Defender Summer Kupal on behalf of Dix, by looking at, and again, this is another issue that we had raised in the briefs, but looking at arguments, exhibits that one were not admitted into evidence, were not made part of the record, to link incidents together, the power and control wheel, the proposed testimony of this quote-unquote DV expert, Stacey Moniz, all of that, psychological. They're trying to argue it's psychological, emotional abuse, that they can tie all of these incidents together under that one theory to make it a continuing course of conduct. That's inappropriate. That enlarges the prohibited conduct under 709-906, which is physical abuse, not psychological, not emotional. There's no power and control that should come into play in these types of cases. Those arguments are arguments for the legislature, not for the courts. The court here just has to decide what is the offense of abuse of family or household member, and we're asking the court to follow the family court's conclusion and find that it's not a continuing offense. Thank you. Because the beginning of this time period clearly falls outside of the two-year window. So as a court who has to make sure that matters that are filed, charges that are brought are timely, that was why I think the family court was concerned that this period obviously is including conduct that would have, if charged separately, would have fallen outside of the period.
Would there be a problem then if the continuing course of conduct was within the statute of limitations?
Yes, there would still be a problem. So that we still adhere to the argument.
The statute of limitations is really not your argument today. It's just basically you're arguing in the lower court rule that the statute itself prohibits the state from charging a continuing.
As a continuing.
That's it. That's really good. That's what before us, right?
Yes. I only raised the statute of limitations issue because I believe that was the motivation for why the complaint was filed in this manner in the first place.
Well, that's your argument why it's prejudicial,
yes.
Right? Because you're saying they shouldn't be able to introduce incidents that occurred before the statute of limitations period.
Yes, of course. Yes. And also, but of course, we're here today because the court was correct to conclude that abuse cannot be charged as a continuing
offense.
All right.
And, is there any Hawaii authority that dismissed a charge for this reason?
In my examination of the cases, no.
The courts don't seem to be focusing on the charge. They all seem to be focusing on the jury instruction as a cure for any prejudice that may result from a charge that may be overbroad, or might even in the Arceo case might include more than one offense in the same charge. They seem to be looking at, well, if you instruct the jury properly, that takes care of all the problems.
That's the ultimate issue in all of the post-Arceo
cases.
Right.
So why can't you just instruct the jury if you don't find that at least one discrete act occurred within the statute of limitations period? You must acquit unless you do that. Why wouldn't that, consistent with Apau and Arceo and all these other cases, be the remedy that the defense will get to cure any prejudice resulting from an overbroad charge?
In all of those cases, the first thing the court determined was whether the statute, the offense statute, precluded it from being proved as a continuing course of conduct offense. And there, in each of those situations, they found that it wasn't, that the statutory language had not
except for our sale.
I'm sorry?
Except for our sale.
Except for our, yes, but all the post-
Which is the leading case.
I'm talking about post-RCL cases.
All right.
But that was the determination that the court first had to make, look at the statute. Does it preclude this case, this offense from being charged as a continuing course of conduct? If it does not, then we have to decide whether the state alleged, adduced evidence of, and argued one continuous course of conduct. Because then the danger inherent in like our sale type cases of a conviction being predicated on inconsistent factual findings, it's not there. If the state's whole theory at that point, evidentiary wise, was a continuing course of conduct, the threat of someone being convicted where the jury didn't agree on the same discrete act as being the offense would not be present in those types of cases. Our situation here is different because the abuse statute, like sexual penetration, like sexual contact in the sexual assault against or on a minor again, under 14 in our sale, like that statute, abuse cannot be charged as continuing offenses. And again, it's from looking at the statutory construction, the plain language of the statute, physical abuse. Once that occurs, it's done. The offense happens. It doesn't go on and on for a two-year period or two-year plus period of time. The offense occurs at that time of sexual penetration,
now,
sexual
contact. If the statute of limitations wasn't implicated in this case, would we be here arguing? Would it matter? In other words, would you be actually arguing that you should have broken this down into three separate charges and not charge one count?
Well, we're not arguing. Of course, we're not saying Mr. DeCoy should have been charged with two. And in fact, at some point, they thought that it was correct for them to charge him with two. But what we're saying is the complaint fails to state an offense. It enlarges the criminal conduct of abuse of family or
incidents within that one count. It's beneficial to the defense in the sense that you're limited to one count, not multiple counts. Well, what's the prejudice to the defense from permitting the state to charge it in this fashion?
The prejudice is still what was articulated below is just insufficient notice of what the charge was. It's still a defective charge because for this two-year period, we don't know what we're supposed to defend against. All that was given to us in discovery were two police reports, the last of which occurred in that March of 2006.
Isn't that the purpose of a bill of particulars as opposed to dismissing the charge? Couldn't the defense have moved for a bill of particulars and then asked the state to identify which incident or incidents it was relying upon to prove the offense?
If the defense could have moved for
right.
a bill of
particulars. Well, why is dismissal the right remedy? Why isn't bill of particulars the route which is typically mm-hmm. taken if the defense
yes.
says, hey, this charge is too ambiguous for us to understand exactly what the state is alleging? Why wouldn't the bill of particulars be the vehicle as opposed to an outright dismissal of the offense?
Well, that wasn't our only, insufficient notice was not our sole argument. We were also saying that the language in this complaint, the charge itself, is not stating an offense because there is no such thing as a continuing course of conduct of abuse. That's the problem. And again, looking at the language of the statute, and the court below was correct, I think, to focus on not only the term physical abuse, but also the enhanced penalties that are attached under subsection 5. For the first offense, it's minimum 48 hours. Second offense, you get 30 days. After that, at some point, it even becomes a Class C felony. That is a legislative intent that each of these discrete acts, each incident, should be charged separately so that convictions could be obtained and penalties enhanced for multiple offenders.
Which means in most cases, your clients wouldn't like it.
Of course. Again, it is very counterintuitive for me not making these arguments, but I do so because in looking at this case in particular, the way they charged Mr. DeCoy under two separate incidents, then decided to make it continuing course all of a sudden because they untimely filed or decided to file a complaint against him, to get around the statute of limitations, they're now going to call it a continuing course of conduct, that they would change theories.
Did Mr. Ega say that the last act under this continuing course would have to come within the statute of limitations?
The last act that we were apprised of occurred March 14 of 2007. The complaint charging continuous course of conduct was filed April 3rd, 2009, well over the two-year period. So I disagree.
But in the connection with the motion to dismiss, the state doesn't have to put on evidence. The court is supposed to take the allegations of the complaint as being true. The state alleged that it can prove this continuing course of conduct into a period of time that was within the statute of limitations. So I'm not understanding how the
actually,
assuming you say that the court did make a ruling on statute of limitations, I'm not understanding how that actually could be a correct basis for dismissing the complaint, because at the allegation stage, the state alleged an offense that occurred within the statute. So,
and I can give the specific page numbers. The court did state that it was finding that the statute of limitations would have posed a problem to the state.
In any of the proceedings below, was there any proffer of incidents post the two incidents you reference?
No.
None within the statute of limitations period, right?
No.
Yeah. That's your point.
Yes, and the only
What about the restraining order? There was an exhibit attached that referred to incidents that occurred within the statute.
There was an exhibit attached to the state's memo in opposition to the motion.
So how can the court dismiss? The court can't take, unless the court took evidence at the motion to dismiss, how can the court make a determination that the state would not be able to prove any incident within the statute of limitations?
The court could dismiss the complaint on its face because it's a legal question, whether abuse can be charged as a continuing offense or not. The court did not have to take any evidence to make that determination, because looking at, again, the language of the statute, which is the primary place to look when construing legislative intent, there's nothing there that would connote prohibiting a continuing course of conduct.
Let me ask you the reverse way. In Arceo, clearly a separate, distinct offense, not a continuing offense.
Yes.
Okay, but the offense was charged over a 9-month period. And the court said the cure, even if you charge multiple discrete offenses in a single count, the cure to that is to give the jury a specific unanimity instruction, or for the prosecution to elect prior to the end of the case, the close of the government's case, which incident it was relying upon. Why isn't the same cure applicable to this case? In other words, if you're right that it's not a continuing offense, why can't the state charge discrete, separate, multiple incidents in one count, as long as the jury is given the appropriate unanimity instruction at the end of trial?
The state can charge discrete, multiple incidents in one count, but it must be in the language of the charging document. That's not what they did here.
So if they just take out as a continuing offense, the charge is okay?
It's not okay. We also argued that it gave us insufficient notice of what we were supposed to meet at trial. I think that's what makes this case so unique. It's a two-year period of time, just two arbitrary dates from February.
But Arceo, they charged the state, the Supreme Court, on a 9-month period of time, which involved at least 5 separate incidents of sexual penetration, that the charge was okay as long as, when you got to the end of the trial, the jury was instructed, given a specific unanimity instruction. So how is that any... Well, how is that significantly different from this case?
Again, I think because if you look at what the precise issue in that case was, it was in preserving the defendant's right to a unanimous verdict, specific unanimity instruction. That was the issue there. Here, this is quite different. It's looking at the charge itself, and really, this falls under the class of a statute of limitations problem. And without putting us on notice of what the last incident that would have fallen within the statute of limitations was, because the last incident, according to the police reports, was in March of 2006. By the time this is filed in April of 2009, that it's way beyond the two-year period for misdemeanor offenses. So really, and the court, again, the court took this as a motion to dismiss for statute of limitations violation, and I think that's what it comes down to. That is the sole reason why this court has to determine whether they could charge continuing course or continuing course of conduct or a continuing offense for the abuse statute. And that's really what's going on here. I think that's why the state charged it as such. That's the only reason.
All right, but if we what I'm saying is that if we conclude that you're right, that it is not a continuing offense, it has to charge as discrete incidents, the state can still charge it over a period of time, can't they? What precludes the state from charging it over a period of time?
They could still charge, and subject, though, to fair notice, right? And that would include what's in the discovery. But, of course, they could charge it over a period of time. And it could be for separate incidents. They're free to still exercise their discretion and charge multiple offenses in a single count.
All right. So what's wrong with this count, then? It's charged over a period of time. They can charge, even if it's not a continuing offense, they can include or they can prove up.
And we don't get there because in looking at the language of the statute itself, it's prohibiting that.
Okay, what about the language says it cannot be charged as a continuing offense? You're saying physical abuse is something that can't happen over time?
Yes, the family court was correct to conclude that the term physical abuse, particularly the word physical, means discrete acts, discrete separate incidents, events, that if you hit someone and it causes them pain, some type of bodily injury, a bruise, the offense is committed at that point.
So each slap is a separate offense?
And as a defense attorney, it's hard for me to admit that, but yes. I mean, if it does, one act would constitute an offense under the abuse statute. Now, the prosecutor still retains discretion.
If in one incident I get the perpetrator punches the victim 10 times, 10 counts?
The state couldn't charge it as a continuing course of conduct, but right. The state would have
discretion. But your argument is they could charge it as 10 counts because each act, discrete act, is a separate offense. I mean, it seems like guys are arguing the wrong side of this thing in this case because it's from the defense standpoint, sometimes it's better to argue it's only one offense, not 10 offenses.
Yes, it is very, very counterintuitive. But in this case, I think what is helpful is looking at, well, why is it that the state chose to put in its charging document the language that over this two-year period, they're charging it as a continuing course of conduct? Now, those magical words only come up in three situations. One, whether a specific unanimity instruction should be granted, and that's looking at it at the end of a trial, so looking at it evidentiarily. Second scenario, 701-109, is there a merger of the offenses? Should the defendant really have been charged with only one offense as opposed to multiple offenses for a series of acts or multiple acts? The third time that we see this magical language is under 701-108 situations where the state has a statute of limitations problem. And that's precisely why they charged it here. The procedural history of this case, prior to the filing of this complaint under FCCR number 0910127, which charges it as a continuing course of conduct, the state had previously charged Mr. DeCoy under two separate complaints for two separate discrete incidences or offenses of abuse. For police report numbers from 2005 and 2006, and at some point, the state, on its own motion, had the case dismissed. Both complaints dismissed without prejudice. And that was in June of 2007, June 4th, 2007. Those two complaints are dismissed, and court minutes indicate it's because it was being preempted by another trial in that family court on Maui. It's not until almost 2 years later, well beyond the statute of limitations for those two offenses, those two police report numbers, in April 3rd of 09 that the state then charges this, the subject complaint, as a continuing course of conduct and attaches discovery that only include the two police reports, these two discrete incidents.
So, okay, so you're saying this, in this case, state would, the defense would be prejudiced because by charging it in this fashion, the state is able to introduce as direct evidence incidents that would otherwise be other acts that would, they would have to justify as 404B evidence.
That is one concern that we raised below, and it is a concern of the family court as well. But the primary reason, this case would not have been able to be brought unless they had charged it as a continuing course of conduct, because that's the only way they can overcome the statute.
The state argues that even under the continuing course of conduct theory, they would be able to prove at least one discrete incident that would satisfy the statute within the statute of limitations. That's their proffer, even in the way they charge it. I don't think there's evidence in the record that established that the state would be unable to prove any discrete incident within the statute of limitations. That wasn't the basis for the court's dismissal.
Well, actually, in the transcripts, in reviewing the transcripts, the court did, one, take defense counsel's oral argument to also be not only a motion to dismiss for defective charge, but also a motion to dismiss for a violation of statute of limitations. And in its oral conclusions of in types of kidnapping, first degree robbery, theft of a firearm, theft of state property by deception, and the Arsale court determined that all of these offenses were statutorily defined as an uninterrupted and continuing course of conduct or manifested a plain legislative purpose to be treated as such or both. That's the inquiry. The first inquiry is to look at the statute itself. And in this case, the family court was correct in construing this HRS 709906 as examining it and correctly concluding that the phrase physical abuse and the inclusion of enhanced penalties for multiple offenders under that statute indicated the legislature's intent that abuse of family or household members could not be charged as a continuing offense.
Is there anything besides just your argument that you should read physical abuse as a discrete incident? Is there anything in the legislative history that says you can't string together a series of assaultive conduct as, quote, physical abuse?
Well, looking at the language of 709906 and the phrase, looking at the plain meaning of the words there, for one, there is nothing that says that it is a continuing course of conduct offense, and there's nothing in the statute itself that shows that the conduct would be ongoing, continuous, uninterrupted.
But isn't that the same as attempted murder or terroristic threatening, which the court has found are continuing offenses?
Well, actually, in looking at the language in those statutes, first of all, taking the attempted murder situation, I think that was, one of the earlier cases. Yes, the Ganal case. There, the language that the court looked at was intentionally or knowingly causing the death of more than one person in the same or separate incident. That would connote, continuing course of conduct over a period of time. In the first-degree robbery situation, that case was the Hoey case. There, the language was in the course of committing theft. So there's language there that shows that the legislature intended to prohibit a continuing course of conduct. Other examples, looking at more recently post-Arceo in the Kealoha case by this court in the promoting a dangerous drug in the first degree, meth manufacturing. The court focused on the word manufacturing as can only having or connoting something like a continuous process, and therefore on its face the statute is allowing for the charging and the proving of a continuing offense. That is not here in the abuse statute.
But there's so many statutes that they found can be charged as continuing. Terroristic threatening, theft. I mean, none of those, when I read those statutes, none of them stand out to me as saying, well, gee, it has to be a continuing offense. And the test applied by the court seems to be focused on the evidence that's presented at trial. Was there uninterrupted conduct, same impulse, plan, intent? Those are all evidentiary issues. How is the court supposed to apply that evidentiary test in deciding a motion to dismiss?
Well, first of all, that's correct. All the post-Arcel cases, beginning with Valentine, this court's Ke Aloha, Raposa, Apau, all of those, the TT1 case in Raposa, in Apau, all of those were looking at the evidence. They're evidentiary issues, the test there was an evidentiary test because the issue was whether a specific unanimity instruction should have been granted. That was the issue, preserving a person's right to a unanimous verdict. And to get to resolve that issue, the question was, well, was it a continuing course of conduct? Did the state prove a series of acts that were not broken, that were unintermittent? Did they prove that in argument?
So how do we apply that test at the motion to dismiss stage where we don't know what the evidence is? It's based upon the state's allegation. The state tells us, well, we're going to put on evidence of a continuing offense. How can we say, no, you're not, and dismiss the charge based upon a motion to dismiss?
I think we don't get to that test, the evidentiary test. And we only get there if this court finds that the statute, 709-906, the abuse offense, can be charged as a continuing course of conduct.